time to listen to the interviews from Island Life on Saturday the 2nd of February 2013. Island Life is our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. It's brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 to 12 by the Humble Pie Village Butchery. You'll find them at 102 Oceanview Road, Oneroa. On Saturday the 2nd of February, Jan Scott talked to Nancy Thompson, Director of Sculpture on the Gulf, Don McKenzie from the Waiheke Local Board on the Auckland City Draft Plan, and Thomas Lazell from Waiheke Sea Scouts.
And now it's my very special privilege to welcome Nancy Thompson. Welcome, Nancy.
Hello.
Oh, hello, Jan.
Hold everything.
Nice to be here.
Just had a technical hitch here.
That's it. Okay.
Right. Now, Nancy is the Artistic Director of Sculpture on the Gulf. Nancy, what does that role mean?
Basically, that role is following the artistic process from the selection when the works are selected to the siting of the works and supporting the artists in the delivery of their sculptures, promoting them, organising their artist talks and selling their works.
That's a pretty tall order. And how did you get involved? How did you get involved with this project?
Basically, I applied for the job. The job came up and it seemed like an incredible opportunity to work creatively on Waiheke, which is two of my favourite things.
Right, so you've got a background in art?
Yes, I've got a background in, well, performance art, really. I've done a lot of performance-type work, which is quite sculptural in its form, and some installation work, so that background, especially the performance style Buto, which I studied for 6 years in Japan, is all about being in space, in nature, and objects in space. And so that's a really nice thing to bring in back into my life again with sculpture.
Absolutely. And how long have you been working on the project?
I began in June. Nikki Cairns, the project manager, started in March, starting to get the event organised. And the artistic process began for me with the selection of the artists, where I was present with the three selectors. And that began in June, up until now.
Right. And when did you actually start installing the sculptures?
The sculptures were installed 10 days before, we started installation 10 days before the opening, and it was a 10-day process and an incredible process up there on the headland with 30 artists all toiling on the land to realise their work.
It must be a real undertaking to put everything together up there.
It is. I keep saying to people it's like the bottom end of an iceberg. You know, we see this sculpture exhibition at the end, which is beautiful and seems so simple, but the actual work that goes into that, the freighting of the works, the installing, the problems along the way, and the great work from both our installation team and the installation volunteers that come and help us put those works up. It's quite a process.
I bet it is. What's the most challenging aspect of it all, of putting it together? Putting the artworks in place?
I think there's always, no matter how much an artist might have come and seen the site or we've sent photos to them if they're away, there's that confrontation with the actual land. I often thought it reminded me a bit of the whole New Zealand process, really, coming, the colonial process, when you're out there on that headland, there's no running water, there's no power, the sun is beating down, and no matter how cool your concept is, there's some very real things to deal with. And I think that can be really challenging because every artist has to come to terms with the land itself in a very real way. And that's a beautiful process because often they change slightly, they have to change slightly their work, and it becomes even better for it. Gregor Kregel's pavilion structure, for example, is different from the proposal because the site was different than what he imagined. So he had to change it to make it work in that site, and that's what I think was one of the components, his skill in bringing that out and making an award-winning work.
Absolutely. And it is a very striking work.
It is. Very playful, very striking. wonderful play on the temporary nature and recycling and environmental issues that the whole exhibition is talking about, really, with all these references to fantastical gardens from the turn of the century where people wandered down to swing on swings and watch water play. It sort of grabs those two extremes.
Mm. And it's also a piece of art that fires the imagination.
Yes, you know, I mean, we're so lucky.
What
we
is
have
it?
This wonderful combination of these fantastic artists with their minds and their thoughts and all that they give us, and it's an enormous process for them. Just what the incredible amount of work that they do creating these things with this nature. So that combination is fantastic.
Absolutely. And of course this year has been a departure from previous years in a number of ways, and one of them is the process where you're going to be able to actually meet with the sculptors and talk with them. And that's a great idea. How is that going to work?
Well, you know, we've got this pavilion structure down at the end, so people can arrive after the walk and there is a space to hold things. So we have music and wine and food. And one of the things we have is we've invited every day during the week artists to speak about their work. And it's very intimate. It's not a lecture with PowerPoint or anything like that. It's usually the artist with about 10 or 12 people, whoever's around. And it's a fantastic opportunity to actually meet the artist and hear how they think. And they're very different. And I've really enjoyed watching the public interact with the artist and the artist interacting with the public in this very informal way. And it's interesting, in the morning walks you often get some people who haven't yet done the walk. So they talk to the artist and then they go away and do the walk. And then the afternoon you get people who have done the walk and then they're hearing more about the work. And it just gives an extra dimension to your experience, I think, if you get a chance to see them.
Yeah, it's a great idea to for people to be able to meet the artists and chat with them about their works. There is a schedule, isn't there, of artists?
Yes, in the coming
up?
In the coming week we've got our very own Matthew Muir on Monday in the morning at 10, and his work, his iconic Waiheke Batch work, which is much loved by all the public. And then in the afternoon, Anthony Cribb, whose work is the one up on the little hillside with, it's actually based on dog training exercises. And he's a really interesting artist to talk about, especially if he shows you some photos or videos of people interacting with his work with dogs. So it's a very dog-friendly sculpture. And then on Tuesday the 5th, we've got Aaron McConchie, who made the QR code flags that are on the headland. He's at 10 o'clock and 3. Wednesday, we have Sarah Brill, who did the beautiful wildfire stems that go down the side. And Graham Bennett, who did the iconic work on the little headland of the overview, which is a big statement on the environment. Then Thursday the 7th, we've got Carolyn Williams, whose work is one Emerit Award, beautiful site-specific work called Field Notes. And in the afternoon, Waiheke's very own Kazu Nakagawa is also award winner, talking about his very unusual and very interesting interactive work, Catwalk. On Friday the 8th, we have Graham Bennett and Delizia Sampero, who was responsible for the temporary signs that kind of frame the exhibition. And then next week, we've got another lineup of artists, Kazu Nakagawa again, our Waiheke's Sharona Montrose, very interesting sound artist that we have on our island, and Matthew Muir again next week, and Christian Nicholson, who did the nudie one. So all of these are on our website if you want to check them out and know what day these artists are coming.
And what is the website?
It's www.sculptureonthegolf.com.
That's nice and easy.
Yeah.
Now, as far as placing the sculptures go, how is it decided where each one will go? Is it decided by the artist because of their concept that will fit that particular spot, or is it done by the committee or the...
No, it's a relationship between the artist, the land, and me as the siting director. So there's various components. The artist will have an idea of where that will be sited, but and then I will go around and see the story of all of the works, because the artist is only thinking of, obviously, of their own work, and we have 30 works. So if you had 30 people wanting the same site, for example, it wouldn't be possible. Or there are logistical problems with actually getting concrete in there or things like that. And then there's the flow of the story. So what happens is that I try to follow and work with the artist as closely as possible on what is the best site for their work and with the overall flow of the exhibition. So as I start putting the pieces together and liaising with the artist, we start to find the right place, change them around until we get it all right.
Right. And I think you mentioned earlier that one of the artists hadn't been on the site before and had to change the work.
Yes, that happens. I mean, ideally with site-specific work, you need to have the artist there with you all the time. But sometimes the artist is busy or they're away or they can't make it, and so it's a different process, and you have to sometimes change it, or if you can't change it, find a way to make it work.
Would the artist have visited the site previously, though?
It depends on the artist. That's the ideal. That's what we encourage, is that they come as early as possible and work with the site and look at the site. That's the best solution.
So how long is it from start to opening? The process?
Well, the artist process begins with selection, which is in June. The call for proposals comes out March of the year before, so in 2 years' time, in March, there'll be a call for proposals. And we received about 118 proposals. And out of that, in June, we had a selection weekend with our selectors, John Gow, Sue Gardner and Lara Strongman. And they selected the 30 works. And that's from then, from June till now.
Right, so the artists have had about 6 or 7 months
yes.
to get their works
yes.
together.
But it's not easy for them, because some of them have also entered into Sculpture by the Shore, for example, in Devonport, so it's a pretty busy time for them. One of our artists, Veronica Herber, who did the tape installation Slowness Shifting, she was in Sculpture by the Shore, and she's also been accepted for Australia's Sculpture by the Sea in Cottesloe in Perth. So as soon as she's finished her deinstallation here, she's flying over to Perth to do another one.
Right. Just thinking of the winning sculpture and the sheer size of it, it must have been a logistical nightmare to get it here. I mean, it'd be a bit like putting a jigsaw puzzle together, wouldn't it?
Exactly. So Sculpture by the Sculpture on the Gulf organises freight for the artists. The artists get their work to a store in Otahu, and we are responsible for getting it from there onto the island. So that particular work was two truckloads of recycled timber that came across on
I
the
guess
ferry.
It would all have to be carefully labelled or numbered.
It was all done on pallets. It was all stacked on pallets and filled into the truck, and then those pallets, it took nearly 2 days of labour getting that wood over to the site, and then six or seven days, the artist and two men actually creating it. And the incredible thing about that structure is there's no steel underlay or anything like that. The wood has actually created the structure as it's gone, almost like a spider building a web.
Right, and that gives it strength.
Yes, it's incredibly strong.
Yeah.
And
wow.
You could see them kind of crawling over it with, you know, with, what are they called? Hammer guns.
Oh, right, yes, with those guns. I can see that. I wonder what will happen to that piece of work after the sculpture.
Yes, well, the thing about very site-specific pieces like that is you can't actually just pick them up and plonk them somewhere else. But they are sellable in the sense that idea, that way of doing things, if somebody wanted something like that on their property, could be made again and could be made even more permanently in that style.
Right. And whereabouts is that artist from? Is he local?
Yes, he's originally from Slovenia. I hope it's Slovenia, not Slovakia. I think it's Slovenia, I'm pretty sure. Gregor Krager, but he now resides in New Zealand.
And the how do you go about advertising, if you like, or inviting people to submit concepts for the Sculpture on the Gulf?
There is a call of proposals that goes out across the networks, like the Big Idea, various websites, and then, of course, our own website and galleries. There's quite a big campaign of sending out information about the call for proposals, and artists themselves are pretty savvy about what's going on and what exhibitions are happening each year.
Is it only open to New Zealanders?
No, it's also open to international work, and that's something that would be really interesting to have in the future, one or two pieces from international artists. We do have Con Demopoulos this year, who is a Melbourne-based artist, originally from Egypt, actually, but he spent a lot of his time in New Zealand when he was growing up and now lives in Melbourne. So he's our international artist this year, if you like. But in the future, I can see that it's getting so renowned now, Sculpture on the Gulf, and it has been quite respected as an exhibition, that I wouldn't be surprised if we had proposals from international artists. It's a more difficult concept to organise because, of course, the costs of getting, we can't pay from, couldn't afford to get them over here, so you have to find an artist who'll be able to get his work over here as
right.
well.
Yes, that would be a challenge, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Now, the sculpture on the Gulf this year has departed from previous years in where it starts and how it finishes, hasn't it?
Sort of turned itself on its head, hasn't
right.
it?
So whereabouts does it start? I mean, if you wanted to do the walk, what would you do? Where would you go first?
As a local, you drive down Nick Johnson Drive and park where you can. There's you can't park right at the end because that's where the buses turn around, but or you can walk up from Matiatia. If you don't want to take the shuttle bus, you can actually walk up from Matiatia to the site where the sculpture called Death Row Rocky Bay Store is and exit there and just walk up the road till you get to the start. And that way you'll actually walk in the direction that the sculptures are sited, which I really recommend because it's a story that unfolds in a particular way. You can go the other way and still see them, but it's nicer and made to be seen going the other way.
Okay. And of course there are shuttle buses that leave from the ferry terminal, aren't there?
That's right. From
that
the
will
back
take
of
you
the
to
pavilion.
The start.
Yes.
Yeah, right.
Every 10 minutes.
Oh, so that leaves from the car park, doesn't it? Or back at the
it
back
leaves
of the
from
pavilion.
The back of the back of
by the
pavilion.
The bay there.
Exactly, by
okay.
the bay.
Right. And takes you up to the start.
That's right. And then from there you go down the little lane and go through and start the walk and going around to the right.
Okay. And I suppose if somebody did the walk the other way, they'd be able to get a bus back down again.
Yes, they would.
Yeah, yep. Right. Now, the other innovation is the pavilion down on the waterfront.
That's right.
Which is absolutely brilliant. It's an inspiration.
It was a huge undertaking and a huge jump, but it's actually worked really, really well. I mean, people are arriving off the walk, come the other way, coming into music and food and wine, all Waiheke products, and the sense of enjoyment down there is really, really tangible. It's really, really working well.
Mm. Well, I had to work late on Tuesday and I got off the 6:30 ferry intending to go up to Manurewa for dinner, and I heard the music, and so I thought, oh, I'll give it a go. And I was delighted. I had a beautiful warm beef salad for $17.
Yes, well, we're really lucky. We've got Anna Schwartz and Nico Fine doing the food, and they're doing a wonderful job. I've heard only praise about it. Really innovative and beautiful food. And it's just a temporary thing, like the whole exhibition. It's just for a few weeks where we have something different. So I think for Waiheke residents, it's a great chance to have a different day out for a couple of weeks.
Absolutely, and at a cost that won't break the bank.
Yeah.
The other thing with the pavilion is that there are also a couple of sculptures in there, aren't there? There's one by Anna Dunsheath.
That's right. We invited artists to... This was separate from the exhibition work, on the walk and the selected and the competition. This was just to have more art at the end of the walk when you have your coffee and your wine. So we invited various artists to show there. We have Anna Dunsheath. It's got a beautiful piece between the two bars. And our much beloved Virginia King has her beautiful Nautilus in there, which looks particularly beautiful at night when it's lit by this aqua spotlight. And also a big piece from David Carson. And as well as that, we have the small pavilion gallery, which has the small works of the artists on the walk. So you can see other things that they make and little marquettes of their work. Mm. So
And you can also buy a program or a booklet with a page on each of the sculptures and the artists, and the really stylish T-shirts.
Yes, yeah, yeah, designed by Strauss.
I think they're great.
They're fun, aren't they?
They are fun.
Yeah, so it's a nice, it's a lovely atmosphere down there, and it's nice to see, it's lovely to see the Waiheke people starting to arrive. At first there was just all the people from town, which it, because it's such a popular event and people just flock to Waiheke for it, and then slowly, slowly you can feel people are starting to arrive from Waiheke and enjoy an evening down there as well, which is nice.
Yes, it's sort of a good way to finish the you know, the walk or finish an evening. It's great. It's a great idea. I don't know who came up with that, but they deserve it.
Was it the chairman of our board, Stephen Tozer? It was his baby, and you know, like all people that have ideas, they're not so easy to realise, and it's been quite hard to do it. And it's, but I think it's paid off. I think it's with an exhibition of this size now, with 40,000 people coming through.
Wow.
To have a big space like that that they can relax in at the end is a good idea.
Mm, absolutely. And it, whilst it is a big space, it's not barn-like.
It's quite stylish, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's quite a... it's a very pleasant spot.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you meet all sorts of people.
And it's just got this great real estate. You're just sitting there. It's looking out at the bay and watching the ferry come in.
Yeah, and watching the sunset.
That's great. That's the best time. Little hint here is to get down there at 6 or 7 o'clock when the sun's coming down and there's music going, and you just look up at the pavilion structure silhouetted with the sunset. It's beautiful.
Mm, would be. Now, the actual hours that you can do the walk, and I guess these are the hours that the volunteers are actually on duty and that the shuttle buses are working, is what, 8:30?
Yes, 8:30 till 5.
8:30 till 5, okay.
And of course you can do it any time. The value of living on Waiheke is people do it many times at different times of the day, and it's quite different.
Mm, yes, it would be. And you know, I think we were talking earlier about doing it late afternoon, sort of around the end of the day when you might get the sunset and the special effects.
Yes, and also creates. Another good time to do it is like 10 o'clock in the morning or 3 o'clock in the afternoon when Kazu Nakagawa's catwalk is activated. So he has the little boxes opened and the costumes come out, and people can wander up and down in their costumes. One lot of the costumes designed by Waiheke's Rose McLeod, and that's the morning session at 10 o'clock. And the afternoon session costumes are designed by two AUT design and fashion lecturers, so quite different works in the morning and the afternoon.
Mm, that's right. Now, is there any provision along the route to buy water or anything of that sort?
There's water at the beginning of the walk, so when you start at Nick Johnson Lane, there is cold water there available, and then the next point is the pavilion. So we don't have the Tea Tree Cafe like before, so that's something people need to remember, to make sure that they get their water when they start.
Right, and that's, you know, they can buy a bottle of water at the start.
Yes, there's water at the start.
Right, okay. Now, the other thing is, of course, there's no charge for this walk, is there?
No, we rely completely on donations, and luckily enough, people are generous. I think it's a much loved event, and I've been personally really surprised just seeing how people arrive and just put money straight in the donation box right at the start. They just know what it is and they support it, so we really rely on that. The other thing we rely on, of course, is our wonderful volunteers. They are just the most incredible ambassadors for the walk for Waiheke. They're up there welcoming people and making their experience, that's part of their experience. You can just see how friendly and wonderful they are.
How many volunteers do you have?
We've got about 100 volunteers. Some of them are in the pavilion helping out with the whole running of that pavilion, and some of them are up on the walk. Some of them are walking around checking on the sculptures, and yeah, they're just invaluable.
I interviewed Linda from the art gallery last month, and it was great to hear that the art gallery were running a course for anybody, but particularly for those who were going to be volunteers in art appreciation and
guiding,
sculpture appreciation
yes.
and guiding. And yeah, I thought that was brilliant.
It's a fantastic initiative, and that it was very successful, and I went along to a couple of the sessions and was very impressed with the way it was run. Alison Robertson ran the courses and she's very experienced, and what came out of that is a series of fantastic guides that now people can at 11 and 3 o'clock get a guided tour. It's a donation only guided tour of the walk, and mm-hmm. be talked through the sculptures and what's behind them. So that's a great new initiative.
Absolutely. Have many people taken that up?
Yeah, people are. People are stopping and waiting for the guide to talk and going with them.
Right.
Yeah.
And of course, we must pay tribute to your wonderful sponsors who've been with you for a wee while now. I think most of them have, haven't they?
Yes. I mean, this Fuller's, of course, is an enormous sponsor for us, and Lexus and Westpac, Genai, and Parsons Brinckerhoff is a new sponsor for us. It's actually sponsored a new award this year, the Parsons Brinckerhoff Award for Engineering Excellence, which was won by David McCracken for his Corton Loop, this big solid floppy loop that's on a rock.
Right.
Yes.
Right, yes. I mean, without sponsors like that, it would be virtually impossible.
Yeah, it couldn't be free.
And it would be hugely expensive. I mean, you must. I hate to think what the freight bill would be for a start.
Yes, it's pretty high.
Yeah, and as you say, with the volunteers, you've got not only have you got the volunteers who are on the track and in the pavilion, but the volunteers that did the physical putting together and things like
installation.
That.
And I must also mention here our fantastic volunteer coordinator, Denise Whitfield, who has just put in so much time and is such a great organiser and makes everybody feel valued, and it's just been a fantastic addition to our project team.
Well, that's great. Now, I think from memory, and I could be wrong here, but I think that this time around, the period of the sculpture on the Gulf has been extended. I don't remember it being quite as long a period in the past.
3 weeks, yeah.
So it finishes on the 14th?
On the 17th of February. So we have, as well as this weekend, we have another 2 full weekends, and, of course, all the week in between.
Yeah, that's great. That's excellent. And what happens then, at the end of it all, what happens for you with, I mean, how long are you going to be working afterwards, sort of doing all the tidy up? And
yes, there's a process of de-installation then, yes, when all the works come out, and the ones that are sold get shipped off to the people that have bought them, and the ones that haven't sold get shipped back to the people that have made them, and the land is restored back to its natural state, and everything is paid off and locked up and put away and tidied up and vacuumed and all the accounts are done, and then we'll write a report on the year in which we have a review of what worked, what needs to be improved, and that's a continual process. One of the things with this board that we have this year is they're wanting to go ahead to the next event as well, so there could be some continuity, which has always been a problem with Sculpture on the Gulf because it's always biannual. It's been very difficult to keep a continuity with the staff, with the team, mm. with the board, and that, so therefore that transfer of knowledge is really important, what happened and what could happen. And
yeah, I guess it's important to document it too, so that if there are a number of new people next time round, they've got something to refer to.
Exactly.
Yeah. How long does it take to disestablish all of the artworks?
The installation period's from the 17th to the 23rd, so it's less time than installation. So that's about a week. Yeah.
Okay, that's not too bad, really, is it?
No.
Well, you think it's 30 of the jolly things.
Yes.
Is it simultaneous, or do you sort of have you got the same team working on each one after the other?
It's the same team, and Jeff Goss is our head installer, and he's magic. He knows it's about the third or fourth time he's done this event, and he has it all in his head, but he has a fantastic capacity for knowing what needs to be done first, second, third, and it's just very efficient.
Yeah. So what are you moving on to after this? Have you got some other project to move to?
Oh, well, there's always new things. I haven't got anything planned yet. I haven't actually had time to think about what's next. It's one of those projects that in order to make it really work, you just have to give your all. So I've done that, and that's my sort of philosophy in life. I trust that, and from that things will follow, I'm sure.
Absolutely. Well, that's great. And that's a great note to finish on, Nancy. We'd better let you get back down there.
Yeah.
We've been talking to Nancy Thompson, the Artistic Director of Sculpture on the Gulf. Thank you, Nancy.
Thank you, Jane.
You're listening to Waiheke Radio, 88.3 and 107.4 FM.
Yes, you're on Waiheke Radio, your community radio station, and it's now my pleasure to say good morning to Don McKenzie. Good morning, Don.
Good morning, Jan. What a very nice morning it is. Another great day in paradise. A bit of rain would be nice, wouldn't it?
It sure would.
Super for the sculpture on the Gulf, though. Very nice to hear Nancy talking about sculpture on the Gulf. What a fantastic event that is. What an iconic event for the island, really.
Oh, absolutely. And it's been recorded for posterity this year by Waiheke Radio. They've interviewed each of the sculptors, and they're available, will be available on podcast on our website. So that's good for history. Good. Now, we've come to talk today, or you've come to talk today, really, about the Auckland City Draft Plan for 2013. What's in the plan for us?
Probably not a very sexy topic compared with the sculpture on the Gulf, but what's in the plan for us? I suppose the key thing is really what do we want to extract out of the plan? What are our priorities in terms of advocacy in with regard to the Auckland Council's plan? So what are we going to build into our local board plans that is significant to the island? But there are a couple of things to be said before we get to those specific issues. The first thing is that, you know, it always revolves around money. It's always the budgets. And the process is that the board, the local board here, establishes its plan. And in 2011-2012, we set up our plan, which basically was a three-year template of where we were headed over the coming three years. And then we got sufficient money to deal with our 11 and 12 specific requests and objectives, and now we're into the 13-14 year, and what has to happen is that we define what it is that we're most keen to progress with respect to the island. But will the council make sufficient funds available for us to achieve those objectives? So we have to enter into an agreement process, and that won't be decided until May. So what I say here is what we're aiming for. Whether we'll actually get funded is another issue. But we'll be in there rooting for Waiheke, as we always are, because that's our job, really. That, yep. That's fundamentally what we're about, is advocating, along with all the other 21 local boards, 20 boards. So we're in competition with these guys to see if we can wheedle out as much for Waiheke as we possibly can. The other sort of issue that I think Waiheke has to sort of face is the rate of growth that's going on. Now, we actually don't know what the facts are around the growth of permanent residents on the island, and so the coming census on the 5th of March next will be sort of, again, quite a defining planning factor, you know, as to where we go in the future. We always, as an island, have to be aware of adverse events. You know, you remember back in 2010, we had Cyclone Wilma. Mm. We had the risk of fires just recently on the island. So those are other things that sort of are variables, or confounding variables, that may shift our plans, the best laid plans of mice and men, and all that stuff. But the final thing is that the Local Government Act, the central government, has changed the Local Government Act and taken some of the social well-being things out of the Act. Now, exactly how Auckland Council is going to deal with that remains to be seen. So that is a concern, and just where we head on that will be a matter of negotiation between local boards and the governing council as well. Because remember, we're in a what we call a co-governance model, where there is a relationship between the governing council, and Mike Lee is our ward councillor, along with 20 other councillors, and the local board. So that's it. Now, fundamentally, we're very keen on protecting our environment. We're keen on the local economy. We're really keen about the physical infrastructure of the island, because that's pretty critical. You know, stormwater, roads, all of that footpaths, all of that sort of thing. And we're keen on the community development. What facilities do we have for the community in terms of halls and the running of them, and the arts and culture aspect, and of course the development of our new library is the headline activity as far as that's concerned right at the moment. But there are lots of other things going on as well. So those are the sort of things that will go on, and that they're the fundamental structural components, I suppose, of our 3-year plan. So what is it that really we're going to focus on this year? What do we particularly want to look at? Well, transport's really important, and the Auckland Council has city centre master plan, for example, and they want to very keen to make Keys Street pretty pedestrian friendly, and so on, which sounds all very nice, but the concern the Waiheke Local Board has about that is that it really shouldn't interfere with the transport hub function of the wharves and the rail terminal there at Britomart. So we've got a pretty valuable sort of transport interchange there between the wharves and Britomart. And given the number of commuters, 1,200 or so a day going backwards and forwards and doing quite a lot for the island's economy, we have to say that we have some concerns about what Auckland Council has in mind with respect to the way that transport hub is being developed. I don't know whether people have picked up on the fact that Shed 10 on Queen's Wharf being upgraded with a view to bringing cruise liners in. That's going to add to the clutter around there, around the wharf area. And there have been long-standing complaints. I think most of us who travel on the ferries will know what a windy and unaccommodating place the wharf is at 10 o'clock at night and so on. It's not a very appealing place. So we need to think about trying to upgrade all of that that area. The other thing that the council has done in recent times, of course, has been to use all of that wharf and Queen's Wharf area as a staging post for events. And we had the Auckland Marathon and the World Triathlon Championships run out of there, and what a, from my point of view, that was pretty chaotic, and we just need to try and persuade the council to take their events staging posts somewhere else into the Viaduct Basin, which is what I thought the Viaduct Basin was all about.
Mm. So this is one of the things that you'll be asking people to make submissions on when you have your stall down at the market on next Saturday.
Too right, it will be. Mm. And the other thing about that whole area is that it's an access point for the whole of the Hauraki Gulf Islands thing. And of course, if you want people to enjoy the Hauraki Gulf Islands and get round on ferries and boats and enjoy the joys of the Waitemata Harbour, then, you know, you need to have sort of good facilities there and so on. So, yeah, that's a key thing that we need to work about.
So what are some of the other priorities that the board has come up with?
Well, one of the other things is the mowing of roadside reserves, the berms on the side of the road. And you'll know that Auckland Council have said to the residents of the Isthmus, I'm sorry, we're not going to mow the grass outside your house anymore, and you'll have to sort it out yourself, and we'll save a lot of money by doing that. Well, that's all very well for the residents of the Isthmus, but it has a different sort of an impact on Waiheke, because our the way we are perceived, the weed control, the fact that we use these burns as green footpaths, I think makes a big difference. So we're going to really advocate for the mowing of these roadside, to continue have our roadside berms mowed, so that the place looks more tidy. We've got better weed control, that people can use the roadside to walk on and not be in the traffic and so on. So,
well, I guess also at this stage, with the way the weather is, it would be a fire hazard if they didn't mow it.
Quite right. Absolutely, and that's a very good point, that would help to constrain the risk of fire spreading and act as brakes and so on.
Mm. Right, you're listening to Waiheke Radio, Island Life, and Waiheke Radio, of course, is your community radio station. We're talking to Don McKenzie about the Auckland City draft plan for 2013 and also the local board agreement. Now, what is the local board agreement, Don?
The local board agreement is an agreement between the board and the governing council that takes the plan and says, okay, what money is available? And of course, you'll be aware that what the governing council, and I guess what we're all concerned about, is the rate of rates increase. And the mayor and governing council have decided that the rate of rates increase this year will be no more than 2.9%, and that's to be applauded. So we have to fit within that budget envelope, and the agreement is negotiating our way through the budget envelope, so that we can say or can agree what our spending priorities will be. Now, it looks to me at this stage, and who knows what will happen between now and May, because it's May when the Administration and the Finance Committee finally decide on the annual budgets. But it looks to me as though within our envelope, we've gone through our priorities a number of times at board level and honed things down so that we are within the parameters provisionally dictated, because there's no point in leaving hassling to the last minute. You've got to negotiate and keep reorganising priorities until you get to somewhere near where you think it matches community expectations with reality. And of course, one of the things that one of the other key projects that will be coming up in this next financial year is the redevelopment or reorganisation of the Ostend Service Centre. Now, you'll remember that when this board took were elected, the first thing we negotiated was a standalone separate library here in Onera, and of course that meant that one of the downstream consequences of all of that was that the Ostend Service Centre was going to have to also be standalone, but also needed much upgrade. And there is a great need to give local staff on the island much better working conditions. They're very crowded. It's a very old building. It's no longer really fit for purpose, and significant redevelopment will have to go on there at 10 Belgium Street. So that again will be one of the fundamental things that need to be done in the next financial year.
Oh, well, nothing's been done to that building for years.
No, you're dead right. And it reflects it.
It does. And all that's happened is it's been added on to and added on to, but that's about it.
That's right. Yes. That's right. That's right.
It must be a nightmare to work in.
And I have to say that one of my personal little priorities, and I'm not sure that I'm going to get away with this, but we desperately need a public toilet in Ostend as well. However, I better not advocate for my personal priorities.
We won't tell anyone.
No, we don't tell anyone, but I'm sure that everybody would welcome that. Stormwater, of course, is always an issue. We have to look after our infrastructure, and again, flood protection, stormwater control soaks up a fearful amount of money, but it's absolutely essential to the protection of roads, to the protection of the environment, and so on. So that's an ongoing no matter how much money you spend, you'd never completely do the job. Biosecurity, of course, is again always an ongoing issue. Cowrie dieback disease on the isthmus, no sign of it here yet. Praise be that we can keep away from that. So those are things that continue to drain the budgets.
Yes, indeed. And is there going to be an opportunity for people to have an input into the local board agreement and their priorities? That
absolutely. Yep. Now, next Saturday at the market, the board will have a little stall there, and everybody's welcome to come along and comment and have your input. And that engagement is really important, so that we hear from people, and then there will be opportunity for hearings on the plan as well, and those dates will be advertised, and people are welcome to come along and make public submissions on where we're headed.
So submissions close on the 25th of February, is that right?
Yes, that's my understanding.
Yes, okay. And the objective of the stall next Saturday at the market is for board members to help public as to how they go about putting in a submission and that sort of thing?
Yep. That's right. And it's public engagement. It's all about you coming along with your ideas, your sense of priorities. We want to hear from people, absolutely.
Right. That's excellent. Well, thank you, John, for coming in. And we encourage people to get down to the market next Saturday to the local board stall to talk about making a submission on the Auckland Council draft plan and also the board's agreement.
Nice to talk to you.
You too, Don. Wakey Radio. Now we are going to talk to our very own Thomas Lazell, who will be on air at noon with Trevor for their theme time radio. But he's come to talk to us about the Sea Scouts. Good morning, Trevor.
Thomas.
Thomas, sorry about that. Sorry to both of you. Okay, how long have you been involved in the Sea Scouts?
Oh, I've been in there for a couple of years now. All my kids are members, so I got dragged in for...
Right. Okay, and what's your involvement with them?
I'm the chairman of the committee.
Okay, right. So tell us a bit about Sea Scouts. What do they do?
So Sea Scouts is all about teaching kids between the ages of about 10 to 14 sailing skills, camping skills, hiking, just general outdoorsy sort of stuff, whatever we think up each term.
So it's not just about sailing?
No, not at all.
Or sea activities?
There's certainly an element of sea activities, but for example, a couple of weekends ago we sailed over to Motuhe Island and then camped there for 3 nights, 4 days.
Okay. And do you have to have your own equipment and boat and things like that? Or?
No, we've got everything. We've got a shed full of boats in various states of disrepair. Mm-hmm. All the life jackets and things. All you have to have is sensible clothes. A wetsuit, ideally, of your own is good. Mm-hmm. And you're in. We also have a cub section, which is for the younger children, about 8 to 10. And they're more focused on sort of land-based activities. It's a bit hard to get eight-year-olds out sailing in groups.
Right, yeah, exactly. Now, is there a charge to belong to the Scouts, Sea Scouts?
There is an annual fee. It mostly goes towards running Scouts New Zealand. We try and keep the fee as low as possible. But I think it's about 180 a year.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And is Sea Scouts associated with Scouts?
Sea Scouts is part of Scouting New Zealand, right, which is part of the worldwide Scout movement.
Right, okay, that's great. And do we have a Scout group on the island?
That's Waiheke Sea Scouts.
Oh, it is. Yes. Right, okay, right. Now I'm with you. Now, if
we're the big shed at the end of Shelley Beach Road. Have you seen it?
Yeah,
the ship.
It's wonderful, wonderful spot there. How do you join?
You have to write to the leaders, and there is a waiting list, unfortunately. It's quite a busy group. But if you're cubs, you need to write to one of the cub leaders. Maybe just send us a message at Waiheke Radio, studio at waihekeradio.org.nz, I think it is. And I'll pass on the details for to the relevant person if you're interested.
That'd be great. How often do you meet?
Normally once a week. Scouts meets on Monday evenings. Cubs meets on Tuesday afternoons and Thursday afternoons. There's two cub groups. Mm-hmm. We're just starting up next week for the next term.
Okay, and what time do they start and how long do they last for?
Scouts is 6:30 till 8 o'clock in the evening. Cubs, I'm not sure. I know I'm at work all day. I never get to go to those sessions. So. Right.
And they meet at the shed at the end of Shelley Beach Road?
We either meet at the ship or sometimes if we're doing something special, we'll meet out at the beginning of a walk somewhere. For example, Cubs is doing kayaking this week, so they'll meet down at Ross Johnson's at Matiatia.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right.
And then the next weekend they're going camping, so they'll meet down by the dirt track, and then we go out across Putiki Bay to this building called the Oyster Shed, mm-hmm. Which is an old council building that you can only walk to on the foreshore.
Okay, and you camp there?
Yes, indoor camping,
why not? Yes, exactly. Now that you're having a garage sale tomorrow at, I saw advertised.
Yes.
It's the first Sunday of the month, is that right?
It's normally the first Sunday of the
month.
Car boot sale, yes. They have been doing that.
Get my terminology right.
They've been doing that every week during the summer, but that was just for December and January. Now it's just the first weekend of the month. It is a good place to go down and sell your old odds and ends and turn them into a few dollars. Just costs $5 to set up your pitch down there. And we normally have a sausage sizzle as well, and the sausages are very popular. They're
right.
A good fundraiser.
That's at Blackpool.
At the old Blackpool school. Yes.
Right. And do you have to give a percentage of your proceeds to the Sea Scouts?
All the profits goes to the Sea Scouts.
Right. So, but if I took some stuff down there to sell...
Sorry, you pay your $5.
I pay my $5 and anything I sell I can keep.
Yes.
Unless I feel generous and want to give a donation to the Sea Scouts.
Oh, some people give a few dollars more or give us $5 for a sausage or something. It's very nice, very helpful. It does cost a lot of money to run a group like that. We do get funding from various places, including the council, which we're very grateful for. But running a sailing program is realistically going to cost money.
Yeah, exactly. And do you get funding from Scouting New Zealand?
No, we pay them.
Oh, okay. Right. So you'd be looking for a sponsor, or have you ever thought about sponsorship?
Well, we have various people who who give money and time and things like that for us. Obviously, the more help we get, the better. One thing we could really use is people who can help do wooden boat maintenance. We've got half a dozen boats of various kinds. We've got the standard 17-foot scout cutters, of which I think we've got about four or five at the moment. We've got a whaler, which is a 26-foot boat. If you imagine the sort of thing that Shackleton would have gone out from, rescued his crew in Antarctica, and went over to Elephant Island in. Very seaworthy little boat, and we've been having a lot of fun with that. We took it out in the Auckland Regatta last weekend, and not in a scout's organised event, but we just took it out to see how it went, and we took it over to Devonport. It took us 5 hours to sail to Devonport.
Oh dear.
But it was great fun. There were so many boats out in the regatta. Last Monday that was, wasn't it?
Yeah, it would have been fantastic. So if there's any boat builders out there or people who've got some knowledge on that line and would like to help out to keep the Sea Scouts boats seaworthy, they need to contact you?
Yeah, again, just come send an email to studio@wahikiradio.org.nz and we'll find you.
That'd be wonderful. Well, hopefully there's somebody out there that will do that.
Okay.
So, thank you very much, Thomas, and I'll let you get ready for your show at noon. Thomas will be back.
Never fear.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Interviews from Island Life, our weekly look at Waiheke people, events and issues, every Saturday morning from 10 till 12, with interviews repeated on Wednesdays at 7 p.m. and Thursdays at 12:30 p.m. Island Life is brought to you by The Village Butchery, the place to go for great cuts of meat and friendly service. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Onioroa.